Utilities and Telecommunications will be in order, and we do have a quorum. So welcome, members, and all those that are out in the audience. Good to see everybody. Today we're going to continue our review on the Conservation Improvement Program. And we have a pretty good list of testifiers here. And I would like to save a portion of our last half hour to some still open, maybe not face-off or wherever I said it was last week, but maybe just a real nice open discussion. And if there's anybody out in the audience that would like to come up and testify, keep it open for everyone. I do believe at the end of this hearing and the information that's given, we will be looking at some kind of stakeholders meeting to make sure that if there are changes to the Conservation Improvement Program, we will have everybody at the table that has something to say and something to approve on the bill or the agenda, and we'll move forward that way. So and I haven't got the dates or any guidelines as far as the stakeholders meeting, but we will be pulling everyone together who wants to talk about that. So first up is Deb Sundin, who is the Director of DSM and Renewable Strategy and Planning for Xcel Energy. Deb, if you can come up. And Chuck LaRue, the Director of Corporate Safety, Security, Environmental Management from Anderson Corporation. Welcome both of you to the committee. And if you could please state your name for the record. Appreciate that.
It's Deborah Sundin from Xcel Energy, and I am the Director of DSM Renewable Strategy and Planning.
Apologize, I got your name wrong. I'm sorry.
It's okay. Sundin. It's the Swedish pronunciation.
Yes, Swedish.
And I am Kirk Hogberg. I manage.
Totally got your name wrong. Totally.
I'm filling in for Chuck LaRue, but I manage the energy and environmental area for Anderson.
How do you spell your last name?
Hogberg.
Thank you very much. Who would like to go first? Ms. Sundin?
I'm going to go first, Senator Rosen. And I want to thank everybody for inviting us in to talk about SIP. You know, just a little bit, my first slide here kind of goes through the history of Xcel Energy and Northern States Power before Xcel Energy's experience in SIP. We have been partners with what we consider partners with the state for more years than I care to count. It's probably over 25 now. And we actually began our energy efficiency programs back in the 80s, where we had an appliance rebate program that was very popular. And over time, we've expanded it with the goals that the state has expanded to where we are now with a fairly comprehensive portfolio that, I hate to say this with a little bit of, I will say this with a little bit of pride, it's a portfolio that's fairly respected across the country. If you take a look at the chart I have here, is we have, through our efforts since 1992, we've pretty much deferred.
Ms. Sundin, pull your microphone, please, okay. A little closer. Thank you.
Is this better?
Yes, it is.
A lot better. Sorry. Since 1992, our efforts have, for the most part, deferred 9 medium-sized power plants. And that's through our resource planning process that we track that and put forward that to the Public Utilities Commission in our planning process every few years. There's always the question that we get is, why do you do it? Why does a utility actually voluntarily and enthusiastically participate in energy efficiency when we're, for the most part, asking that our customers use less of our product? And I've been answering that question for a long time, and, you know, the answer is very simple. Xcel Energy, you know, really is and tries to be an environmental utility. It is one of our premises, and it is one of the things that we operate our utility under. And energy efficiency is one of the best environmental choices we have. It also provides our customers, which is actually a customer satisfaction piece for us, it provides all our customers with options to control or lower their energy bills. Rates go up. There's nothing we can do about that. It's just a product of time and inflation and our expenses. But if we give customers the tools to take a look at how they use energy and figure out in their own homes and businesses how they can actually reduce that use, it actually gives them back some control of their bills, which has been very helpful to us over the last 20 years. For us, it defers capital investment in our plants, transmission, and distribution systems. And we do put our plans together in energy efficiency and DSM, including load management, in our resource planning process with the Public Utilities Commission. And it is rolled up as part of the Xcel Energy's lease cost plan. And it is one of the best resources we have. The other reason that that has enabled us to be enthusiastic about it in Minnesota is that Minnesota has helped provide financial mechanisms that remove financial disincentives for us. And that's a huge issue for us, but not in Minnesota right now. We get good cost recovery. We're allowed to earn on it. We get to share in the benefits that our customers reap from us doing energy efficiency. So it has kind of removed that issue for us at this point so that we can be enthusiastic about it. On the other side, our customers, if you take a look at why customers do energy efficiency, a lot of these shouldn't surprise anybody. It is an opportunity to control their bills. A lot of our customers do want to operate as efficiently as possible and have that as a goal in their homes and their businesses. One of the things that happens if you provide really solid energy efficiency programs, especially in the industrial and the business side, is that sometimes it can attract, because you're helping to pay for improvements inside the factories and plants, that it actually will attract capital into Minnesota, especially for national customers, that they might improve a plant here versus in another state because we are helping them pay for it through the energy efficiency efforts. And then the other issues is that it really does make businesses more competitive if they can get their energy costs down and more in line. And on the residential side, if it's not only bill saving, it actually, depending on the energy efficiency measure, can make their homes more comfortable, which is important to them. I'm just going to quickly go through some statistics from 2010. Xcel's energy spent last year on the electric side. We do both electric energy efficiency and gas energy efficiency. On the electric side, we spent just under $72 million. And as you break out the cost, there in the pie chart below, 61% of that was spent on our business programs, and 26% were spent on residential and low-income programs, and then we have administrative other in there. And if you move to the other side of the chart, what we were able to achieve was 411 gigawatt hours, and that represents about 1.3% of our sales goal, or our sales for the year. About 71% of our achievement was in the business side with our business customers, and about 29% was from residential and low income. Now, I wanted to just say a little bit right here is that it looks like we're a little bit skewed to the business side, and there's a reason for that. The potential for energy efficiency and the energy use of our energy that comes from Xcel is predominantly in the business sector. So if you want a really cost-effective energy efficiency portfolio where you're getting the gigawatt hours pretty much for the cheapest amount of money for our ratepayers, it has to include a fairly hefty business portfolio because it is where we can get the cheapest energy efficiency and it is where the potential is. The residential customers, we try very hard to offer opportunities on the energy efficiency side. We try to give all classes of customers opportunities to participate. One of the issues on the residential side, however, is the federal government has been very strong over the years in updating appliance standards and manufacturing standards. And that is actually a good thing. That's not a bad thing for the energy efficiency market because it's the best market transformation vehicle you have. But the issue is that if the federal government is going to mandate, you know, higher efficiencies in the appliance market, there's less and less that we can actually influence with our residential customers. Look quickly at the gas side. We spent a little over $11 million on gas energy efficiency last year. Actually, 42% of that went to residential customers, another 14% to low income, and only 30% to business. It's a little bit of a flip, kind of flip picture there. On the business side, however, 65% of our achievement came from our business customers, and that actually can change from year to year. It depends on once in a while, and I'm going to actually show you an example of a project we brought in last year. We get these, what I refer to as mega projects from our industrial customers, and we don't get them every year. They're very piecemeal. We'll get them once every couple of years, every 3 years, and they can actually shift these statistics for us quite dramatically on the business versus residential. But gas is a direction that we can help residential customers with. It's the insulation, it's your furnace, it's your water heater, it's kind of your building shell. There are more opportunities on the gas side for residential customers, and that's why we have a little bit higher effort for residential here.
Ms. Sundin, mm-hmm. I'm back to the electrical
okay.
achievements. So it's safe to say then that your dollars that are being spent will be directed more towards the business side of it because that's where the greatest return will be? Or are you still concentrating a lot in the residential side? Perhaps it's an equal amount of growth in either side when you look at how many dollars are being put into it and how much can come back. Can you kind of give me a rundown?
Yeah, it's a little bit what we really look at is we do potential studies. Probably every 5 to 6 years, where it actually outlines the opportunities in every sector for energy efficiency. And we do go after the potential, and it is fairly skewed to the business side. We actually, in 2010, our results for residential are actually higher than they have been historically, and that's because we have really increased the size of our CFL program over the last couple of years. CFLs are a huge opportunity. Lighting is a large use, electric use, in our residential customers. And CFLs has provided us probably the best opportunity to help them save in their homes.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. And I'm not going to go through all of these, but I wanted to give you a flavor for the programs that we are offering in our portfolio. As you can see, this is the business program offerings, and we have electric programs, gas programs, and the combination are programs that go after both electric and gas. If they actually are a customer from us that use both fuels, we have programs that will look at both fuels holistically. And even if they come at us in that it's an electric program, we do try and give them hints on how they can save on their gas side and try and lead them to their gas utility to actually implement. On the residential side, we have a fairly large portfolio as well. One of the things I will have to say, though, that a couple of the large programs on the residential side for electric, as I said, it was CFLs. By and large, we got most of our achievement from residential from CFLs this last year. The rest of these programs have good participation, and they're for the people that participate, they're actually very good offers. But we do get the predominant amount of our achievement through lighting. On the gas side, it was kind of a combination of our furnace rebates and our efficient shower heads program. And furnace rebates were helped in the last couple of years by the fact that there's a tax credit. If you install an energy efficient furnace in 2000, I believe it was 9 and 10, you get a tax credit up to a third of the cost, up to $1,500, and that has actually helped our furnace rebate program quite a bit in the last couple of years.
Ms. Sundin, what is the Home Energy Squad?
That is actually a program that we're piloting with a couple of groups in the state that are implementers, DSM implementers, and it's a trial to see if we actually, and let me see if I am... How it basically started was, the theory was, you would go down into a neighborhood and you would stop at people's homes with low cost, easy install measures and try and get the low hanging fruit in the neighborhood and get everybody to do something. We've kind of changed the program around from that initial thought process, and now we do schedule appointments. And we charge the customer, I believe there's a couple of different levels. I'm not sure on the details, but one is, I think, a $50 where they pay for materials, and one is $75 or something like that, where they pay for the materials, but the program offers the installation for free. And so a truck comes out to their house with a couple of installers. There's a couple of things. We put in CFLs. We'll put in a thermostat, a setback thermostat. There's some weatherization measures that can be done, but they're kind of low-cost, easy install, and we help the customers do that.
And is this program being paid by Xcel through Community Action Councils, or is it federal dollars that you're tapping into, or... How do you pay for
it? It's Xcel helps pay for the customers that are in our service territory. I believe CenterPoint Energy also helps support the program in their service territory. And so it is a SIP It is a SIP project.
So there are no federal dollars?
I don't believe so. There might be somewhere in the background, but I don't believe it's the primary contributor.
And you are working with the Community Action Councils, the
mm-hmm.
Minnesota Valley? Okay. Well, did you know about that? I don't know about it. Great.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. And just, I had one last slide. I talked about residential CFLs. I also talked about how we can get large projects through our gas program from industrial. And I just wanted to highlight before I give it over to Kirk from Anderson Windows is just to highlight another project that came through us this year that was a very good project, a very good partnership with us, with Faribault Foods. We were actually going through a project that did heat recovery in their plant down in Faribault. They actually reduced their natural gas use by 30% and their water usage by 20% and their sewer flow by 25%. Now, this is not a normal project. This, you know, took a few years of planning, and it was a fairly sizable project for us, and the customer was very motivated. but this is what, you know, when everything works well, this is what we can achieve in the market. And with that, I'm going to give it over to Kirk.
Cindy, do you have a lot of other businesses that are looking to tap into a project such as Faribault Foods?
We actually have
a waiting list.
Well, there isn't a waiting list because there's no caps on our programs. And we have account management sales group that works with NXL Energy that works with all our largest customers. And working them with on energy efficiency is actually, they spend about 50% of their time doing that. It is one of their focuses.
You don't have a cap on the dollar spent from Excel?
No, we don't. We do have to ask permission. We basically, the rules were for a lot of years, is that we could spend over our approved budgets if the cost effectiveness met or was better than what was in our current budgets. Now, if we overspend a program, I think it's by 25%, we have to go into the OES and ask approval. And we had to do that a few times with lighting. Lighting was a huge program for us on the commercial side last year, and we had to go in a couple times and ask for more money.
Mr. Hogberg.
Kirk Hogberg.
Hogberg.
Yes. Thank you for the opportunity to address your committee this afternoon. Again, my name is Kirk Hogberg. I work for Anderson Corporation. I manage the energy and environmental area. I belong to a corporate group, so we get to support our facilities across the country and see what types of energy efficiency programs are available, not just in Minnesota, but in other states as well. Just a brief little history on Anderson. We were founded in 1903 in Hudson, Wisconsin. After about 10 years, we outgrew the real estate we had, and the company moved to Bayport, Minnesota in 1913. The company employs about 11,000 employees at 16 manufacturing locations and 20 distribution sites across the country and up into Canada. We have 5 locations in Minnesota. Our corporate headquarters are in Oak Park Heights. Our largest manufacturing facility is located in Bayport. And we have other facilities in Cottage Grove, North Branch, and Roseville. Annually, we manufacture millions of windows and doors. Anderson Corp, like other businesses, is always looking for ways to become more efficient. Increased efficiency, whether it's in how we take our orders or in the form of using less energy, saves money. The SIP program administered by XL Energy has helped Anderson to become more energy efficient at our Minnesota facilities. And we've actually been able to take some of the learnings from Minnesota and apply them to other sites across the country where they don't have similar programs. Just a few program highlights that pertain to our Minnesota facilities. The programs that or program offerings that Deb had up on the PowerPoint, we've taken part in the majority of those. SIP provides us a mechanism to offset the added expense of purchasing higher efficiency equipment. So typically, if we're looking at an expenditure, you'll come in with a baseline type of equipment, but to get more efficient equipment, it's going to cost more money. And the SIP program offers incentive to make up for that difference with a reasonable payback, which is normally a couple of years. In the last 5 years, we completed 10 SIP-qualified energy studies at our Minnesota locations. These studies identified energy-saving opportunities. They estimated the implementation cost, and they also determined or provided a simple payback. So we were able to prioritize the projects that were identified in the studies. A typical study will identify from 10 to 20 opportunities. Some of those opportunities may have paybacks much less than a year. It could be a few months, and then some are going to be up in the 10 to 20-year range. And as a result of the studies, we're able to prioritize those and also to use the results of the studies for a roadmap going forward. In the last 5 years, we've implemented 78 energy conservation projects under the SIP program. Some of the projects we've done are some of the mega ones, I believe, that Deb referred to. We did build a new steam plant in Bayport that burns wood byproduct that's generated from our manufacturing operations. We also built a warm water recovery system in Bayport that helps heat our Bayport plant with waste discharge water from a nearby power plant. So we pipe the water over, and in the winter months we use that to help heat the facility. We've also done numerous lighting retrofits, motor upgrades, and equipment efficiency improvements. And SIP has offered support for all those projects. As far as results go, in the last 5 years, SIP-related projects reduced our electrical usage by 15 gigawatt hours, which is 14% of our 2006 baseline. In addition, in the last 5 years, SIP projects reduced our natural gas usage by 53,000 MMBTU, which is 12% of our 2006 baseline. Based on my experiences, no other states or provinces up in Canada offer energy conservations that really come close to the Minnesota SIP program as it is administered to us by Xcel. The programs do help us save money and remain competitive. So.
Well, that's fascinating. Mr. Hogberg, do you have out of the, you had 10 qualified SIP energy saving studies. Are you actively involved in an 11th? And how do you keep going with your energy savings? Is this something that's, have you picked all the small projects, that the smaller projects that are doable in the plants? And wait for the larger ones to come on down, or
A lot of the short payback projects are low hanging fruit. We've done, and it's getting harder and harder to justify projects going forward. The studies we've done, one of the studies was at our Cottage Grove plant, which was built around 2002, I believe. When that facility was built, it was a pretty modern building. We did a study there, and we identified a lot of things in even that new of a building. So going forward, one of the things that SIP also offers us is the ability to combine projects. So if we have a project that has a very short payback and does not qualify under SIP, we can combine that with a project with a longer payback and form one bigger project. So that's been an opportunity. Another opportunity of the SIP program.
Interesting. Senator Brown?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I was wondering how the rates that you pay in Minnesota for gas and electric, how does that compare to Anderson's facilities in other areas?
Very competitive. There are some areas in the country which are cheaper, but if you go out on the East Coast, it's also much more expensive.
Thank you.
Senator Dibble?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was wondering, do you finance these improvements, and do you use the payback as the source of repayment, or do you just pay cash?
We have not used outside financing yet for any of the projects.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks. And how do you pay for the studies, you know, the kind of the initial look? Do you roll that into the overall project cost?
Right now, one of the offerings of the SIP program is to help reimburse you for studies also. So if you do a qualifying study, we're able to get reimbursed for the majority of the cost for that.
Thank you.
Which is another benefit.
Interesting. Anybody else? A lot of food for thought there. It's very interesting. Well, thank you very much, Ms. Sundin and Mr. Hogberg. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And then we are going to have the Rural Electric Association testify. So if Mr. Kajos, Mr. Gazal, and Mr. Connett, if you could all come up, please. I appreciate it. I apologize. I slaughtered your names. Please forgive me. Try. Please state your name for the record.
Gary Connett with Great River Energy.
Welcome, Mr. Connett.
Thank you. Do you want the others to introduce themselves now? Or?
Oh, they can wait when they testify.
Okay. Well, actually, Madam Chair, John Gazal and I are going to tandem this presentation that we're about to make.
Okay.
I've got 3 points to cover this afternoon, and they are: how are things going for Great River Energy in regards to SIP? What are the challenges that we have in regards to SIP? And lastly, some suggestions that we might offer. I have 9 slides that I'm going to go over in the next few minutes to do that. And in the middle of all those 9 slides, John Gazal of Connexus Energy is going to provide a little more detailed look from a retail distribution cooperative perspective of Connexus Energy. So that will get started.
Mr. Connett and members, we do have a SIP update from Great River in your packets from last week.
Yes. Well, just quickly, and I think most of you know who Great River Energy is. We're owned by our 28 member retail distribution cooperatives. The map shows where those are, all the way from the Arrowhead region of Minnesota all the way down to the southwestern part of the United of Minnesota. Nonprofit, democratically member-controlled, focused on meeting member needs. And so as Deb talked about how important it is for Xcel to meet conservation goals, it's important for us too. After all, these are our members, these are our owners, and we want them to use energy wisely and be as conservative in their energy consumption as possible. Our membership actively participates in setting policies and making decisions with us. If we don't make the right decisions at our local level, we can change out the board pretty fast. A couple of notes. One is we serve about 1.7 million people. That is about 640,000 meters or thereabouts. Predominantly residential, and I'll come back to that in a little bit because I think that's an important point that we'll be making today, is we're predominantly residential. A couple of other points. Recently declining energy sales, something new for us. In the past, Great River Energy was one of the fastest growing utilities in the upper Midwest, and it's certainly gone by the wayside in the last couple of years, and I'll show you that as well. And my last note is basically that we have no future resource needs in the foreseeable future in terms of power plants. Now, that said, if we had to retire something or something like that, that would change that perspective. But when we look at future resource needs, it's predominantly wind that we're looking at. I wanted to share this one with you in terms of energy sales, because Deb, again, from Xcel, kind of emphasized this one in terms of a lot of the energy savings comes from commercial and industrial. And our demographic just doesn't give us that opportunity as much. In terms of our sales at Great River Energy, and this is the pie chart above, 64% of our sales are to residential consumers. And by the way, in some ways, those residential consumers are far apart. We don't have many consumers per mile of distribution line. Many of them are very rural. And so it even adds a further distinction. 64% residential. You can see how it shakes out in terms of small commercial and large commercial. Small commercial for us is strip malls and things that you see kind of out in the countryside and those sort of things. On the bottom half of this slide shows just the 2009 energy sales statistics for Minnesota, and you can see how we're sort of flip-flopped in terms of where our sales come from. Our sales, again, are mostly residential as compared to, say, the investor-owned or the municipals. And so it really makes us different, and often we're challenged with that difference. That said, in terms of how well are we doing, we've increased and improved our rebate program since 2007, and every utility has. And I think the list that Deb went through, most of the utilities are offering those sort of programs. We have to. We've increased our energy savings achievements each year since 2007, and I'll share that with you in a slide in just a moment. And lastly, we've met all the energy savings goals and all the spending requirements in 2010, including a low-income spending requirement. So in terms of how well have we done, this is a chart that just basically shows how we've stepped up our energy savings. In 2005, it represented about 0.3% of our retail energy sales, but it's gone up quite a bit since then. And this year, or last year, 2010, we met 1.2% of our energy, our retail energy sales. I might note that we look at the energy savings goal in two pieces, and Commissioner Grant described this last week. That goal of 1.5% breaks down to two pieces for us. One piece is on the customer side of the meter, and that has to be 1% of that goal, or two-thirds of the goal. The other 0.5% can come from utility side of the meter improvements. And so what I'm showing here is how well we've done on customer side of the meter savings, which represents that 1%. And indeed, in 2010, we exceeded the goal slightly.
Mr. Connett, is that sustainable, the 1.2? Or what's your projections for 2011?
Madam Chair, I'll come to that, and I'll give you some challenges that we think we're going to have in that.
Okay.
Well, here they are. Back to this. I'm back on this residential again, because I think it's important. There's a distinction here I want to make. We're serving predominantly residential, and not only residential, but to some degree, rural residential. There's fewer residential energy savings opportunities. Some of that comes from diminished residential construction activity, and I have a slide that I'll show you in just a minute that shows that. Improvements to appliance standards. As Deb said, this is a good thing, but it's taking away some of the opportunities we have. You can't buy a poor or inefficient refrigerator anymore. You can't buy a poor or inefficient air conditioner anymore. When you replace those, you're buying good products. And for us, that takes away a rebate opportunity. It takes away a potential savings that we could claim on our SIP goal. Reductions of deemed energy savings. As these appliance standards improve, the assumptions or the deemed energy savings that we can say we're saving is getting smaller. Again, it's not a bad thing. It's just the facts of life, and it's taking away some of the opportunities. Deb mentioned CFLs. That by far, has been our best program. Because remember, our energy savings is coming on the backs of our residential customers. And a lot of that is CFLs. And CFLs are getting to be pretty much the name of the game now. And we're not going to be able to claim energy savings from CFLs fairly soon. So again, it's not a bad thing, but it's taking away that opportunity to meet the savings goal. Lastly is the economic slowdown. And it's changing customer buying behavior. You know, this is one that nobody's been able to put their finger on and say what exactly is going on out there. But we know something's going on out there. And customers, it's probably due to the economy, it's probably due to a number of things, but they're slowing their behavior in terms of buying new refrigerators, changing out air conditioners, doing some of these things. They're a little concerned about whether I can afford it right now. And not only that, but we see something, too, that's really unusual, and that is we think there's conservation activities going on out there that we're unaware of. We've educated them. They've heard a lot about it. They've done some things, and they're not asking for rebates. They're just doing it. And so there's some unaccounted conservation that's going on out there that we can't claim a rebate for.
So, Mr. Connett, going back to the pyramid in slide 4,
yes.
You're saying you've in the lighting section, you've pretty much tapped that out. Is that correct? The CFLs and the, I would assume there's some room for the LEDs coming down the pipeline.
Yeah, you know, and there's still some opportunities for lighting, and we'll continue to have those programs. We've been really big on holiday lighting for LEDs, providing rebates for those. And so there's opportunities, but I think as we go further down the years, the challenges become a little harder because some of those opportunities are going to be diminishing. And LEDs, I'll have to say, frankly, they're not quite here yet. I doubt that many of us have LEDs in our homes today. And it's just a technology that's coming, but it's not something that we're going to be rebating and seeing a lot of that going out the door here anytime soon.
So, Mr. Connitz, then in this pyramid,
yes.
I would assume Great River is looking at right going up the pyramid is your next push. I mean, you've mentioned that there's probably some insulating and ventilation occurring on its own, maybe some of this air sealing, but what's next on the docket for you as far as meeting your goals?
You know, this pyramid was really something we put together for consumers in terms of if you're a consumer that's looking at how to improve your home, start at the bottom. Understand how your home uses energy today. And then start doing some low-cost options and work yourself up the pyramid. And so I showed this just to give you a sense of this is what we try to encourage our members to do. Now, when it comes to us in terms of what are we going to do to meet the SIP goal, we're a little challenged in terms of appliance standards being improved, lighting maybe going away until we really get a good LED technology. We are an electric utility. We don't heat a lot of homes. Gas does. And so when you look at weatherization and insulating and ventilating, some of those things really go towards the gas company. We don't get a lot of electric savings from those. And so it becomes a little challenging when you're predominantly residential.
Madam Chair?
Oh, Senator Dibble, yes.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I was just hoping to understand the appliance issue a little bit better. I certainly understand as we move into the future, you know, with improved appliances as people are swapping out their appliances, eventually everyone will have a new refrigerator because refrigerators don't last forever, washers, dryers, et cetera. But maybe I just don't understand where we are in terms of that changeover. Or maybe I just don't understand the premise. Is the issue that utilities help customers purchase the right kind of refrigerator versus another kind of refrigerator that might be available, or they help purchase a new refrigerator and get rid of their old refrigerator? And if that's the answer, then how many folks have swapped out the refrigerator? I mean, I have a sense there's still a lot of refrigerators to go. So we have a while yet before that really presents itself as a problem if you're participating in those purchases with rebates or something like that.
Mr. Connett.
Madam Chair, Senator Dibble, there's still an ample opportunity for refrigerators. I'll give you an example, though. One concern that we have is we provide a rebate for someone to go out and buy an energy-efficient rebate or an energy-efficient refrigerator. Mm-hmm. And it's called free ridership. You can't buy a bad refrigerator today. And so we're giving you a rebate to do something that we want you to do, but the fact is you couldn't buy a poor quality refrigerator today. So it's this free ridership thing, and we're thinking to ourselves, we're not getting any energy savings. That customer was going to buy an Energy Star refrigerator anyway. And so we struggle with this idea that it's free ridership. We're giving a rebate and not really collecting any energy savings. Now, the program that has been really good to us is a refrigerator harvest program, where maybe they're buying a new refrigerator, but we're taking the old one. And for that, there's an assumed energy savings that's fairly high because we're going to get that old dog out of the garage, and we're going to get some energy savings from that. But the problem we have with appliances is this sort of this free ridership. We're going to give you $50 to buy a refrigerator, but you would have bought it anyway.
Senator Dibble.
Oh, so there's no evidence that folks wouldn't have sped up their purchase because of the rebate. They would be replacing their refrigerator anyways.
Mr. Connett.
Madam Chair, Senator Dibble, we don't have much evidence that suggests people are outgoing buying out new refrigerators and replacing old inefficient ones. You know, our evidence would suggest that right now consumers are taking a kind of a conservative approach to buying major appliances.
Sure.
Senator Dibble.
And then one more question. Is the assumption with the refrigerator harvest program that they drag their old refrigerator to the garage and plug it in and have extra refrigerator, not just leave it out there?
Mr. Connett.
Madam Chair, Senator Dibble, what we have on our harvest program is it has to be a refrigerator that we're going to recycle, and it has to be an operating refrigerator. When we go to pick it up, we have to plug it in and see that it works.
I see.
And so we're recycling a working refrigerator.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Senator Brown?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. These SIP goals were set up about 5 years ago. Would you say that SIP goals need to be modified for the realities of 2011?
Mr. Connett?
Madam Chair, Senator, I've got some suggestions or recommendations at the end of my presentations that will suggest some things like that.
Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Benson.
Back to the pyramid, Mr. Conant.
Yes.
It appears to me that the lowest cost options are at the bottom, and we work our way up. At current utility rates, whereabouts are we on this pyramid for cost effectiveness?
Mr. Connick.
Madam Chair, Senator, John Gazelle is going to address that.
You lucky Mr. Gazelle.
We get lucky once in a while. Well,
Mr. Connick.
I wanted to finish up on this slide in terms of, I've talked a lot about the residential energy savings opportunities or the lack thereof. I wanted to also mention that the limited commercial and industrial opportunities in terms of, we just don't simply have them. And so when it comes to meeting the goal, we're challenged because we don't have those great opportunities. In terms of getting energy savings back to these residential customers, it comes 1 kilowatt hour at a time, one house at a time, and they're far and wide between. We would love to have large commercial loads where you can just, you know, go in there and make some huge savings. We'd love to have density in terms of customers, but a lot of our co-ops simply don't have that. The last thing I wanted to mention that's kind of a twist on all this is there's a reduced value for energy savings currently. And what I mean by that is we buy all of our energy at Great River Energy in a wholesale market called the Midwest Independent System Operator. Many utilities here do. And we also not only buy our energy from that Midwest Independent System Operator, we sell our energy to them as well. And one of the things that we've noticed since 2007 when this legislation has passed, the cost for energy in that wholesale market has come down dramatically. And so what it's doing, it's changing the cost-benefit equation for us. Some of the energy efficiency things that we could do a few years ago that were cost-effective are on the margin now in terms of being cost-effective. And so these are things that we continue to look at. And as the MISO market prices go down, it starts to put some pressure on what's cost-effective from our perspective in terms of conservation.
Madam Chair.
Senator Howe.
Madam Chair, I would going back to the improvement on appliance standards, speaking from 20 years of experience with Sears, that, back when there was a lot less Energy Star appliances in the showroom, the rebates allowed you to trade somebody up to an Energy Star appliance. And I think with the compliant that a lot more things are becoming more Energy Star compliant, I think that there would be an argument to say that this program's becoming less effective in that area just because there's more things that a consumer is going to buy that is already going to be Energy Star without having to use the rebate to trade them up. So just wanted to point that out.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Howe. Mr. Conant.
Okay, I'm going the wrong way. Sorry about that. Madam Chair, committee, this is the slide that was our growth engine in the past at Great River Energy. Every year we grew by 4 or 5% annually in terms of energy sales, and our growth engine was new home construction. And it fell off a cliff in about 2005. We went from somewhere around 20,000, 19,000 new homes each year to something less than 1,000 today. And this was what allowed Great River Energy to grow each year, is home construction. It also allowed us to meet some conservation goals because all these homes, these new homes, gave us conservation or energy savings potential. New refrigerators, new air conditioners, all kinds of things going into that home that gave us opportunity to meet this SIP goal. And it's basically dried up on us right now. And as a result of that, we've gone from somewhere around a 4 or 5% growth down to something that's negative today. And our expectation is that negative growth is going to continue for some number of years in the future. And as we think about this, we can't, again, put our finger on one factor that's destroyed our growth. It's a number of things. It's the economy. It's these new appliance and lighting standards that we talked about. It's our consumers' efforts towards saving energy. It's conservation efforts that we're not even aware of that are all kind of driving this growth down. My last slide, and then I'm going to turn it over to John Gazelle, is this MISO market and this idea that what's cost-effective today is different than what might have been cost-effective just a few years ago. In 2007, when this legislation was passed, the average cost for energy in this MISO market was about 5.2 cents a kilowatt hour or $52 a megawatt hour is what I'm showing here. Since then, it's dropped off to around $29 or $30. And so what was cost-effective in 2007 in terms of what are we avoiding when we do conservation? We're avoiding 5-cent energy. What are we avoiding when we do conservation today? We're avoiding somewhere around 3-cent energy. And so when we look at all the portfolio of conservation programs we offer, some aren't as cost-effective as they used to be.
Yeah.
And with that, Madam Chair, I'm going to turn it over to John Gazelle.
Mr. Conard, I do have a question, and unfortunately it's back to your slide number two.
Okay.
You're talking about the number of million of people, 1.7 million people that you serve. You're predominantly residential, recently declining energy sales, and no new resource needs in the foreseeable future. What exactly does that mean? What's
okay.
the foreseeable future? And
yeah. You know, when we look out about 20 years in our integrated resource plan, we don't see any new power plants that we need to build to meet our growth. So, you know, the idea is we're not going to be down here meeting with the PUC looking for a certificate of need for a power plant for a long time.
Interesting. Okay. Any questions? Senator Dibble.
Thanks. That caught my eye, too, Madam Chair, and I was wondering.
It looks like.
I was wondering why that is. Is that a recent phenomenon based or recent fact based on? These declines that you're pointing to, or is that made possible by your SIP efforts? You know, that's kind of one of the premises, of course, of SIP is that we avoid the need for new energy sources. Do you know why that's a case?
Mr. Conard.
Madam Chair, Senator Dibble, there's a number of things that have changed our resource plan recently. One is we had a forecast that showed a continuation of this 4 or 4.5% growth. One might say we were pretty poor at forecasting. And based on that forecast, we made some decisions on power plants that are in the ground today. And we need to grow into those power plants now, and it's going to take some time. That's one factor. Another factor is just we didn't expect this economy to do what it did. And we didn't expect all these other things, the conservation that is taking place out there, which is a good thing. All these factors have lined up and said, you know what, when we look at it, we've got to meet this renewable standard, which we're going to meet. And when we look at our forecast, there isn't much new generation that we need.
Thank you.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Conant, do you have any idea how per capita energy consumption is doing for your customers, your members? Is it?
Connick.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, John Gazelle has got a.
There you go.
Mr. Gazelle, you're on deck.
Please state your name. Expectations of Mr. Gazelle.
Yeah.
good afternoon, Madam Chair and Committee. My name is John Gazelle. I work for Conexus Energy, where I am the Vice President of Power Supply there. Conexus Energy is a distribution cooperative. We're based in the northern metro area. We have 125,000 customers. Our service territory spans from the Blaine, Coon Rapids area up towards St. Cloud, over towards the east near Cambridge and down to the St. Croix River. The customer mix in the north metro area would be primarily suburban, some commercial load. As you go farther out, there'd be hobby farms, potato farms out by the Big Lake Becker area. I should say that we're a member of Great River Energy. We purchase all our power from them, and we account for about 20% of Great River Energy's purchases. In the 2000 to 2005 timeframe, we had called explosive growth in our service territory. There are some years when we added 5,000 customers. And to put that in perspective, 5,000 customers would be roughly equivalent to plopping down a city of 15,000 people in your service territory every year. We could hardly keep up with building substations, lines. GRE had to scramble to build generation to meet that increased load growth. And then the world changed in 2007, which is the next slide. This slide shows our energy sales by year. And as you can see from year 2000 to 2007, we were growing at a very rapid rate. And then in 2007, the economy tanked. And as of last year, that would be 2007, we've experienced a decline in absolute growth, 5.4% over 2007. And you'll see just a little blip upwards in the growth in 2010, and that's actually caused because August 2010 was a very hot year and we had extra sales. So our anticipated growth for 2011 will be flat from 2009, 10, and 11. And the reason for the drop-off in growth, and we look at that, a number of reasons. Part of that, maybe a third of it, might be due to SIP. When you look at our SIP records, that could explain about a third of that. And then the remainder would be a combination of other conservation that may not be counted, but we think it's also primarily due to the economy. In our area, we have some of the highest number of mortgage delinquencies. You probably saw in the paper about a week ago, there's a report that came out that said the northern and northwestern counties in the metro area, that would be Wright Hennepin, Sherbourne, Anoka, Isanti, had some of the highest mortgage delinquencies in the state. And I'm going to show this to you. Every week, there's a newspaper in Anoka published. It's the Anoka Union. They have a legal section, section for public notices. Here are two sections, and these sections are 50 pages in total, and they're nothing but mortgage foreclosures. And it's been this way every week for the past 2 years. So this is some of the stress that the people in service territory are going through. If you look at the shopping centers in our area, you'll see vacant storefronts where Circuit City or Linens and Things may have been there. That's vacant. If you go to the smaller strip malls, you'll see boarded up storefronts there. Eventually that will recover, but it will take time. We have very little industry in our service territory, and some of the industries that we have shifted from three shifts down to two shifts or one, so that also contributes to the decline in energy sales. I'll move on now to some of our SIP performance. We've been ramping up over the past few years as the SIP requirements hit full force in 2010. In 2010, our preliminary estimate, these aren't audited numbers, but just our first cut at this, we'll have spent around $4 million in SIP and achieve energy savings about 1.3% of the goal on the retail side of the meter. And again, Great River Energy and others can account for reductions on the utility side of the meter. At Conexus Energy, we've had some pilot SIP programs. At last week's hearing, there was a brief discussion of some of the behavioral programs that are in place. We have one that's right now in year three, where we have 40,000 customers enrolled, and we've seen some significant energy savings in that. And then we also try other tactics, and one is in the Andover area, in the city of Andover, we have a smart meter pilot. In 2010, we finished a pilot where we had in about 125 homes smart thermostats and home displays, and we used that to try to determine changes in usage between people in the pilot versus a control group. This year in the Andover area, we're going to ask customers to enroll in a time-differentiated pricing rate where the rate they pay varies on-peak, off-peak, and it has an extreme critical peak pricing when the weather's really hot and demand goes up. So we're constantly looking at different ways to find value for our customers. Now, that said, in 2010, we did analysis looking at what's the impact of SIP to our customers, how effective are the different programs. And through that discovery process, we also learned how the economy is impacting us, and I'll share that in the next slides. This slide here is a result of an analysis where we looked at each individual SIP program. We have pretty good records on how much it cost us. We then try to determine how much benefit we get from the SIP program, so we determine what's the savings we get on peak, off peak, what kind of demand reduction do we get from that SIP program, and put together a model where we applied that towards a MISO forward price curve to determine what the savings are. And this is just a real simplistic graphical representation of some of the results. And you'll see at the bottom of the bar chart is what you might call the low-hanging fruit, the programs that are in the money that are cost-effective. Then you should start walking up the bar chart. You'll see programs that are less cost-effective on a dollars per kilowatt-hour lifetime basis. Now, in the middle of the chart, you'll see some red lines. and the red lines represent what the avoided cost might be by saving that kilowatt hour. What do you save? And of interest, I put on there two bar charts at the top for if you could avoid building a new nuclear plant or a new coal plant, how much would that cost on a levelized basis? So the DOE released in December of 2010 new power plant costs. So if we were in a build mode and if we could save a kilowatt hour, GRE wouldn't have to build a new coal plant or nuclear plant. So you're looking at the benefit from a SIP program, SIP reduction, around a 10-cent a kilowatt hour range. However, with where the economy is right now, with MISO long in generation, with GRE long in generation, the avoided cost is about a third of what it would have been, say, in year 2007 when we were growing gangbusters. So one of the takeaways we had in this analysis is the benefit, the payback we get is about a third of what it would have been if we were in a build mode. If we had a new power plant in queue, then the savings you might get from that could be fairly dramatic by reducing a kilowatt hour.
Excuse me, Mr. Gazelle. Senator Jungbo?
Let's tell him something else.
Oh. Okay, sorry. Please continue.
The next slide is a bar chart showing the main cost components that would go into a bundled retail residential rate. Our retail rate for residential customers is around 11.3 cents, and there's in this chart here, there's three components in that. In the bottom, in blue, would be the distribution component. That's what Connexus does. We build the lines and hook houses up. That's around 3.7 cents a kilowatt hour. And then GRE accounts for about 75% of the cost of our doing business. And if you further break that out at GRE, they have fixed costs for generation and their transmission. And right now, GRE's variable cost, or their marginal cost, if you add or subtract a kilowatt hour from purchase from GRE, is really 2.9 cents a kilowatt hour. So on a percentage basis, the marginal cost is about a quarter of the retail rate. So what that means is if a customer purchases $4 less from Connexus Energy, whether it's conservation or they turn the lights off, if they reduce buying from us for $4, our costs only go down $1, and we still have the fixed expenses shown in the red and the blue on the chart. So we have a shortfall of $3, so that has to be made up in a rate increase. So the net impact, if a customer reduces $4, there's $1 we get, and then the $3 we have to bump the rates up to recover that revenue. Now, in the economy we have right now, if we could somehow wave a magic wand and get new businesses to come in or get growth back, if we could increase our growth 4% because of the scaling factor, if we could increase our growth 4% by getting new customers in your businesses, it only cost us 1%, and we could afford the rest of the customers a 3% rate reduction because we would have more billing units to spread the fixed costs among. And that goes back to the fact that the graph I showed you earlier, with our reduction in load growth, we may not get to the 2007 historical growth levels until around 2017 or so, because the economy recovery is so slow. We've never seen it recover this slow in the history of our company. This is my last slide, and I'll turn it back to Gary. So for the implications, the fact that we have more residential customers than commercial causes some hardship for SIP programs. It is easier to dole out the SIP programs to commercial accounts. And then I won't go through all these bullets, but as Gary iterated, the opportunities start diminishing and the cost of doing a residential program is more than commercial. So if there's no questions, I will turn it back to Gary to finish his last slide. The per capita question. Thank you, Gary. If you can pass this to the committee. This is a chart showing our residential usage per month from 2000 to 2010. And this is not weather normalized, it's just off our database. And as you can see, it floats from about 820 to, I think it peaked at around 905 and then back down to around 970. So there is no real definite trend in there. It's not going this way or that way. It's just kind of floating flat. It's just one quick read. So I just leave that with you for your information.
Anderson, do you have any questions?
Well, Madam Chair, it's just interesting, and it's hard to know what this, whether this means that there's more opportunity or not, or whether people are just buying bigger TVs and using less energy, but having more efficient appliances, or whether they're just staying, well, I mean, if they're conserving on the one hand and then buying bigger stuff, then it's a wash. So it's really hard to tell what this means. And it would be interesting to dig down and see, you know, if all of your efforts have, you make it sound as if you think you've kind of penetrated the market in most residential customers' homes. And I wonder if, you know, there's some customers that are going to be interested in conservation and go out and buy CFLs, and some who maybe aren't. Or do you think everybody's just doing it as just sort of a market transformation? Any kind of anecdotal information about that?
Mr. Gazelle.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, I will answer it and turn it over to Gary, who's got some more information. I know at my house personally we do both. We conserve. We've changed out a lot of light bulbs to CFLs. We've unplugged other appliances. But now we've got computers running more. We've got more computers. We've got a high-def television. So it's all of that happening. And I believe, Gary, you mentioned we're going to be doing some kind of a survey to find out what the customers have. Gary?
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson.
On it.
We're just embarking on a conservation potential assessment that will help us kind of get a better handle on what's going on out there and what's the potential still out there. So I think that'll give us some view into the future in terms of what we might have out there that we can still do.
And then, Mr. Connett, you will adjust your program or initiatives going forward. And Mr. Gazelle, as far as how to reach, since you are primarily all residential, I would assume the campaign has to be tweaked and motivated towards this, what you find out from the survey. Exactly. I mean, you definitely have gotten into the residential area. People know about saving money, but what do you do next, and how do you get that message across?
Well, Madam Chair, hopefully this conservation potential assessment will kind of help us determine some of those things, because it is sort of a struggle. And, you know, like, I should have the answer to your question, but I struggle with what is next in terms of residential homes. What are we going to make them do to save more energy? I'll give you one example. Is last year we started providing a electronically commutated motor rebate for gas furnaces. And one might argue, well, why are you worried about gas furnaces? Well, that motor in your blower motor in your furnace uses a lot of energy, electric energy. And so for the first time, we're providing a $100 rebate for replacing your gas furnace. And so those are the things that we have to look at. I mean, clearly there's still some opportunities out there, but we need to kind of turn every stone over and look for them, and this conservation potential assessment will probably help.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair, the only other – I just wanted to make the observation that I'm not sure what the other utilities would say, but I think you're the first one that's come up and said energy is so darn cheap, you know, it's kind of too cheap to meter in Minnesota now, and we don't need any more. We have too much already, so – interesting, and, you know, it's hard to know how long that will last. You think 20 years.
Madam Chair.
That's not how I heard that.
Senator Anderson.
Maybe I heard it wrong.
You know, we don't need any new future resources for the foreseeable future. Our projections with the Midwest Independent System Operator, that MISO market, is for depressed prices going out to like 2015 or thereabouts. It's not something that'll last forever, and I think we're all going to have higher rates again. You know, again, but it clearly is a new era that we haven't seen before.
And Mr. Connor, these are you're including the energy resources that you have outside of the state of Minnesota, too. That's included, such as your coal plants in North Dakota. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Okay. Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Madam Chair. This is such a paradox, and Senator Anderson kind of put her finger on it, and I find myself, you know, really struggling. You know, struggling. I understand part of the depressed price is the economy. How much, Mr. Conn, do you think is attributable to our SIP efforts? I mean, I remember when we were first looking at the SIP initiative a few years ago, there was a fairly sound argument that was the product of some research done by the, I can't remember the name of the organization, but the Upper Midwest Energy Efficiency Consortium. I can't remember what they're called exactly. They gave me an award, and I can't remember their name.
At least you're honest.
They talked about how you know SIP efforts really will bring energy prices down in the market. And now I see how it kind of cuts the increment of savings, which causes us to be kind of a victim of our success. But how do we have a sense of how much is attributable to SIP efforts and bringing energy prices down? How much is just because the economy is tanked?
Mr. Conant.
Madam Chair, Senator Dibble, it's a hard one to define. John mentioned that they think that they can track a third of their energy reduction to the conservation the SIP program. Mm-hmm. You know, what's causing the prices in this MISO market to come down are a number of things. Natural gas prices are at an all-time low. Wind is driving down prices. Literally in the nighttime hours, there's some hours where they'll pay you to take energy. It's a whole new dynamic. And I mean, it's not saying that conservation is still not a good thing. It always will be a good thing. What it's saying is that when we look at what's cost effective today, it's not the same as it was in 2007.
Madam Chair, I was just looking at the charts here, and it looks like your energy savings is been pretty constant, but it looks like revenue spending on those savings has went up and is starting to go up at a greater pace. And I'm just wondering, with the reduced energy cost, are your margins staying the same, or at what point do you say, well, we can't afford to do the SIP program anymore? I mean, what do you see as far as operating your business and maintaining your business, I should say.
Mr. Gazelle.
Madam Chair, Senator Howe, my boss, our CEO, constantly reminds me that with the economy stressed and our customers in dire straits, having a hard time paying their bill, we need to try to do everything we can to make the best business decision for them. And going back to Senator Zellin's suggestion, what has changed, maybe I might frame it this way. Given scarce resources that the state and our customers have, given the situation we're in right now, being long a generation, you determine what's the best use of the resources. If you make an investment in a conservation device for SIP that lasts 5 years, and if you're going to be long a generation for 5 or 10, is that something we should do or not? What's the payback for that? I think those are questions that we need to answer as stewards of our customers' money. When the economy picks up again, and if we look at avoided costs being extremely high, then this will change again, and the benefit will be back in the money. But for right now, the benefit that we see that our customers pay, it's diminished compared to what it was just a few years ago.
Any further questions? Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Two more questions. One has to do with the pilot SIP programs, slide 13 of the Conexus Energy presentation. How with the smart thermostats, the time differentiated pricing, I know Minnegasco has gone to some of the inverted block rate pricing. What potential do we see in some of these initiatives, and also how do we anticipate the customer acceptance of some of these? This is a big change, and some people get a little cranky about these changes.
Madam Chair, Senator Dibble, in the pilot that we did in Andover, we were excited as staff to go out and offer some of these programs to our customers in Andover, and in the get-go, we wanted to offer some of the technology along with the pricing, the time differentiated rates, including having them pay a premium when the cost of electricity goes up. Before we launched the program, we had focus groups with customers. We had 3 focus groups, and we asked them what you thought, and we hit a brick wall. We misjudged the customer's acceptance. We totally missed the mark on that. There was pushback to seeing the price in front of them. Mm-hmm. So that was a learning moment for us. So we shifted gears in the pilot and elected to roll it out in year 1 without the pricing. We just had the technology go out. early adopters pick that, so was it representative of a customer base? I'd say no. So this year we're going to try to offer it again to the same customer group on a volunteer basis. Would you be willing to participate in a time differentiated rate? That is a barrier. It's got a lot of opportunity, but there could be a downside with customer pushback. We've seen some of that, and we want to learn from that and see if the customers would be willing to accept that.
Thank you. Madam Chair, the second question. To Senator Howe's question, and your bottom line and selling less energy and what that means for being able to run your business, are you looking at the decoupling pilot that the PUC is doing with Minnegasco? Is that a interesting idea? Looking at SIP initiatives as you know, kind of virtual generation, being able to kind of de-link your bottom line from the amount of energy that you sell. It's kind of a hard concept to communicate, but eventually it's like looking at SIP as a virtual way of generating energy by saving energy and realizing some consideration for that.
Mr. Gazelle.
Madam Chair, Senator Dibble, a couple ways to answer that question. One is from a decoupling standpoint. As an electric cooperative, we have no stockholders. The stockholders are the customers, so one and the same. So there's no real need to do decoupling, because to the degree we lose any revenues from a decline in sales, then next time the board looks at the rates, we make up for that lost revenue. Thing we've looked at and have not made a decision on, at what point do you unbundle the bill to break it out into the various rate components so the customer can better see what the true cost is for the different components? And we've talked about that, but we've not done that yet.
But, Madam Chair.
Yeah, Senator Dibble.
But you did, that's an excellent point. I didn't even think about that. Y'all are a nonprofit. You do have issues around addressing your fixed costs. You were pointing out the fixed cost chart, and as the increment squeezes further, you're not able to support your fixed costs. So there might be some area to explore in there.
And members, we have Mr. Kajos from Kajos.
I believe Gary, Ms. Conant had one more slide.
Oh, did you? Oh, okay.
Madam Chair, I'll go through this really quickly. And since you've mentioned something about a stakeholder process, this is where these sort of suggestions could be introduced. And so basically we came down here with some thoughts in terms of how might we change SIP if we were able to. And so these are things that can be brought up in that stakeholder process and vetted in that process. But essentially it's establishing an energy savings goal based on customer demographics. I think you've heard today that getting the goal, meeting the goal with residential consumers is a little more challenging. So is it possible to have a lesser goal for residential consumers? The second one is to reduce the energy savings goal if utility is experiencing negative growth. We have a lot of our cooperatives that are not growing at all. They're actually going behind. The third one is to exempt new loads that increase energy sales by 10% or more from the energy savings calculation. That's a mouthful, but what I mean by that is we've got some co-ops in southwestern Minnesota where their energy sales increased by 25 or 30% overnight. And it was with the introduction of one ethanol plant. And all of a sudden, their sales went up 30% overnight. It also increased their energy savings goal by 30% overnight as well. And there's not many opportunities to make that ethanol plant more efficient. When they're built pretty darn efficient. So the goal goes up by 30%, but they don't end up with any more opportunities to meet that goal. My last one is just in terms of determining a kilowatt-hour energy savings credit for each dollar spent on education and promotion. I think as utilities, we all know that something's going on out there in terms of people are taking action. And if it doesn't come back to us in the form of a rebate, we don't get credit for it. And so for all the efforts that utilities do around education and promotion and marketing, there ought to be some sort of mechanism that recognizes that for all those dollars we spend, there's some sort of energy conservation that's taking place. And it would be something as simple as saying, let's just give it a value. I mean, after all the deemed energy savings is an assumption to some degree. And so let's deem an energy savings for dollars spent on education and promotion. It's 3 or 4 kilowatt hours per dollar spent. I don't know what it is, but it's something fairly simple. And so these are some recommendations that we could take to that stakeholder process, and we would look forward to that opportunity.
Absolutely. Mr. Conant, I believe that the 10% increase in energy sales is in my district and Senator Magnus's district.
Okay.
It's my district, Senator Magnus.
I appreciate certain pain, Senator, but I don't want all the pain.
Madam Chair, that ends John and myself's testimony.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Any questions there? We do have Mr. Kajos from Rushford, is that
yes.
correct?
Yes.
So we'd like to.
Madam Chair, committee members, yes. My name is Ted Chos. You've heard some excellent testimony, and I'll categorize it as from the magnum, mega, and very large players in the utility world in Minnesota. I'd like to now bring the discussion back and the perspective from the minis, if you will, in the utility world, which are a lot of players in outstate Minnesota.
Could you just state your name, please, Mr. Kajos,
yes.
for the record?
Once again, I am Ted Chos, Vice President of Marketing and External Relations with Tri-County Electric Cooperative, headquartered in Rushford, Minnesota. I appreciate the opportunity to provide information and perspective to the committee from the standpoint of a rural electric utility that has been fully engaged in the Conservation Improvement Program in Minnesota. As a preface to my remarks, I feel it's important for all to recognize that all electric utilities are not the same. Not in size, business structure, and certainly not in scope of work or mission. This is true not just of utilities in general, but also of electric cooperatives. Tri-County Electric is a member-owned and managed not-for-profit cooperative. Our mission is simple. TEC exists to provide reliable electric service to our members at an affordable price. There's no profit motive, and there's no incentive to have members use more electricity than is necessary for their consumption. Tri-County currently serves just under 13,000 meters, which is a little bit above average for cooperatives, but also about 10 times less than Conexus Energy, which is the state's largest electric cooperative. We serve mainly residential loads, 97%, with a few commercial loads, around 3%, and we have two large industrials. Our power supplier is Darylin Power Cooperative, which is headquartered in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Darylin Power currently serves 25 cooperatives located in four states, Wisconsin, Iowa, Illinois, and Minnesota, all with widely varying laws regarding electric utilities. Only three of Darylin Power's members are located in Minnesota. Like a lot of electric cooperatives, we've also seen our sales level off in recent years because of the downturn in the economy. At the same time that our sales have dropped off, our fixed costs have also been increasing. We've also had to rebuild a large portion of our system after damage from a serious flooding a few years ago back in 2007. I mention this because these differences, business model, size, load profile, system makeup, and the local economy, all present different challenges in meeting the goals of the state's Conservation Improvement Program, and yet none are really recognized in the program. Our nonprofit business model providing reliable electricity at an affordable price directly relates to the goals of the SIP program. Distribution cooperatives like TEC have been at the forefront expounding on the theme, use energy wisely, for decades. Cooperatives are proactive in this manner because it's good for our members, our member owners, consumers. Prior to the changes to the statute regulating SIP in 2007, the focus was on education and marketing the value of personal energy management. This is well within the realm of what an electric utility can do in a realistic and cost-effective manner. Making changes to lower consumers' energy consumption comes down to change in a mindset that results in behavioral changes. Cooperatives have been successful in reducing energy consumption using this approach. However, I do have concerns with the structure and requirements of the program that went into effect the first of 2010, and which we have been working on since early 2008. First and foremost are the extensive labor requirements to implement, process, track, and report the SIP activities and results. Second is the expense of the program, which does not include any administrative costs, which for our relatively small cooperative runs just under $1 million per year. Third, the reported savings are deemed, meaning they are not measured or verified at the supposed point of consumption, leaving the true energy consumption picture to be framed by more tangible effects such as changes in the weather from year to year and the health of the economy. The savings requirement is simply not practical when run by utilities which have no direct control over an individual's energy consumption. There are successes to celebrate in spite of the shortcomings of the program, though. Because cooperatives have a relationship with consumers as member owners, there's a long-standing trust and credibility that is used to encourage members to act on their own behalf. This makes our educational marketing programs effective. An example is last year, through the capabilities of our automated metering infrastructure, AMI, which is a component of the smart grid, TEC rolled out the My Meter program. This is an online tool for members to view their daily energy consumption, track changes they make to their use, and measure their energy savings. In less than 1 year, Tri-County has approximately 1,000 members signed up and using the program. This is impacting almost 10% of our members, and they are using it to use less energy. The change to the law to include a low-income spending requirement to the SIP program was a positive move. Now all utilities will target a segment of our consumers that need help reducing their energy bills the most. Here the situation is different. People don't have the money to make the changes to conserve energy because most are not lifestyle-based, but due to poor building structures and the appliances within. This is something a utility can help with. For the most part, the incentives and the rebates that small utilities offer are nothing more than free riders, which have no effect on the decision to use less energy or not. They are an afterthought that people call the utility about after making a purchase. In reality, they only serve to report on a deemed savings action that would have occurred without any incentive. This is not a cost-effective approach. I would submit that through education, marketing, load management, we will achieve the goals of the SIP program in a cost-effective manner. Encouraging and supporting behavioral changes with the information and technology to facilitate consumer action is what utilities can and should continue to do to promote conservation and the wise use of energy. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Howell.
Madam Chair, Mr. Jost, and I guess the others there, do you have any percentages on how many members of your organization has participated in some form of a SIP program? Do you have any participation numbers that you could share with us?
Yes, we do.
Mr. Jost.
Just while I'm looking for the exact numbers, it's a relatively small number compared to the total number of members. But for 2010, or which was the last filing was for 2009. I have I'll give you the 2010 numbers, although they're not, the savings hasn't been audited yet. It ranges widely. You know, if you're talking about educational or marketing activities, where we're hitting through our newsletters, we're looking at 10,000, 11,000, 12,000. But if you want to look at the various components of it, you'll look at fluorescent light bulb recycling, for instance. You're looking at a number like 300. If you're looking at appliance rebates, the number is just shy of 900. But they bounce all over. There's no, you know, one member may have participated in five different, you know, prescriptive rebates. So the actual number of members, it's like was mentioned earlier, when somebody builds a new house, that's a great opportunity. You're buying a whole set of appliances, furnace, lights, everything. So that one member may apply for 30 incentive rebates. So if you're looking at the number of members that are actually or the consumers on your lines, it's probably a small percentage of the total.
Senator Hill.
Madam Chair, without knowing how many members you have, it doesn't draw context for me. I mean, I'd either need to know the number of total members you have to put those in perspective, but a percentage would probably be more helpful for us to say that, you know, 5%, 10%, 20% of the members participate in some form. And I understand that you might have one person participate in four different programs, but some sort of statistic there would be helpful to put into context for us.
Madam Chair, Senator, we have roughly 13,000 meters, roughly 10,900 members. However, the rebates and the deemed savings are not tracked by the member. They're tracked by the savings and the rebate that has caused the savings. So I don't have any information as to as I said, one member may have applied for many rebates, so that information just isn't available.
Okay, I think.
Senator Brown?
No.
Yeah.
We've got a follow-up here.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Goodsell.
Madam Chair, Senator Howe, in terms of the percentage participation for the rebate programs at our cooperative, it's around 5% based on 2010. We also have the behavioral program that's going on, and that accounts for 40,000 customers out of about 110,000. It's probably around 30-35% for that particular program.
Thank you. That's helpful.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Brown. Thank you.
Thank you, Metsy. Now you got me off guard. Hearing all that noise out there, I'm wondering if Madison's moving to St. Paul. In regards to residential customers, in your opinion, is the SIP program, the goals of 1.5%, are those still realistic? Should they be reduced? Do we need them at all? Do you have any opinions on that that you want to share?
Well, actually, that's a very good question, Senator Brown. I was going to ask that, too. So, and you could each take a turn, if you like.
Madam Chair, I can start. And my my suggestion here was to establish energy savings goals based on customer demographics. So essentially, I'm saying here is that maybe there is a different way to establish these goals, and that for if and we could do this through the stakeholder process, but it might result in something that says if you're predominantly residential, your savings goal is going to be slightly less because the opportunities are slightly less. I wouldn't go so far as to say let's just do away with it. I think there's some really good things that are happening with all of our conservation potential that we have out there. And as a co-op, we're member-owned, so we ought to be willing to help our members. But I do think there could be a distinction, and I've addressed this before in this committee when this legislation was passed in 2007. I think to put all the utilities in the same bucket probably isn't fair. And I think there's a way to maybe make a distinction between residential and commercial and make it a little more fair.
Okay. Mr. Goodsell.
Madam Chair, I think the issue becomes if you have a flat 1.5% goal with no cost effectiveness as a way to temper that, you could run into some trouble. So if you have a safety valve, so if it's not cost effective, and if you determine that a certain class of customers isn't cost effective, then you decide not to do that as a business decision. That would be one way to address it. Another way would be to come up, as Gary said, different weightings for residential versus commercial and industrial. But I do think it's something that is worthy of addressing.
Mr. Joseph?
Madam Chair, yeah, I agree that it should be addressed or could be addressed based on demographics. There's also several different G&Ts and IOU systems that operate in the state, all have different generation mixes and different systems or different situations as far as their system planning. So you have a whole range of different wholesale power costs that the distribution cooperatives have to deal with. So the answer is yes, there's it should be addressed differently.
Great. Senator Dipple, Senator Anderson, and then Senator Stump.
Thank you, Madam Chair. G&T, hadn't heard that one yet, so just was educated on what a G&T is. I thought I had all the acronyms down. Generation and transmission. And that's actually my question. We haven't talked a lot about that, the generation and transmission side of the equation, the 0.5. How much potential do you think is there? Better generation, fewer line loss, all kinds of stuff. We had that great chart from the Office of Energy Security that showed, the big arrows and how much in the, big arrows kind of going towards the end user and the end user ending up with only this much energy from all, the sources. What do we think are the possibilities there?
Madam Chair, Senator Dibble, there's a lot of opportunities at our power plants. I'll give you one example, and we're going to be using it to meet that 0.5% goal. And we changed out the turbine blades at our power plant in North Dakota. And changing out those turbine blades allows us to get 20 more megawatts out of an 1,100-megawatt power plant. It allowed us to get 20 more fuel-free megawatts. And so if that power plant's running at about a 95% capacity factor, we're going to get 20 megawatts each hour out of that plant. In terms of energy savings, that far exceeds our goal. And so we're able to carry that over for a number of years. Mm-hmm. And so and those things we want to do anyway because we're trying to keep our rates down. Right. And so we need to squeeze out every bit of efficiency at our power plants we can. But there's a lot of opportunity at our power plants to squeeze out some more efficiency. We do it because it's a good business strategy, but it's nice to know that the legislation allows us to count that towards our SIP goal as well. But it kind of goes back to what John Gazelle was saying in terms of if we went after the lowest hanging fruit to meet the 1.5% goal, we might spend more time at our power plants first, because that may be where the most cost-effective energy savings for us is right now.
Senator Anderson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I certainly appreciate what you're saying, that one size fits all might not fit you perfectly, especially under current circumstances. But I have to point out that I think just last week, was it the Chamber of Commerce, I think? You can correct me if it wasn't last week, and if it wasn't the Chamber of Commerce, but I think that's who it was, who said, oh, maybe we should exempt those big customers from SIP because it doesn't work very well for them. And so now we're hearing you say, well, maybe we should exempt us because we're all residential. And so it's like the problem is, I mean, I understand what you're saying, and it may be we need to listen to what you're saying, but we don't want to take away the point that we need everybody to do the most that they can cost-effectively to save energy. That's a good thing for Minnesota. It's a good thing for ratepayers. So good thing for the environment. So, and I hear that you're committed to that, and I appreciate that.
That's right. Okay. Senator Stump.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I kind of like the that number three up there. You're talking about southwestern Minnesota. Well, we're going to have a situation in northwestern Minnesota that's going to be just the same as yours is when that new canola oil crushing plant comes online. And I think the load requirements for that's going to take, I think, about a third of PKM Electric's energy. So it's a huge amount. So, I think we do need to make some adjustments. Obviously, it seems to me that most of the problems right now hinge around the economy. When you have 20 to 25% of all homes in America underwater, and you have high unemployment, and many factories not working at full capacity, it just makes sense that there is an oversupply of electricity on the market, but that I'm hoping that it turns around, you know, within a few years. You're projecting about 2015, and that may be very accurate. That's not that far away, but I think once that happens, then, you know, things will turn around in terms of a lot of things. So.
Mm-hmm. That's a very good point, Senator Stone. Senator Dibble, we've got one more, and then we're going to close this down.
Thanks.
And,
Madam Chair, thank you. And just responding to that, Senator Stump, two quick points to make. One is, you know, we do provide for cost effectiveness, and that's in the law. And if, in fact, the effort that we go to is not cost effective, it's outside the law. Now, if we need a better way of articulating that or doing a better job of measuring, auditing the savings, et cetera, we should definitely do that. I don't want folks to walk away thinking these expenditures are not cost effective, or, you know, it's just effort that doesn't result in significant benefit, which includes a significant savings in terms of energy prices, which is, I think we've all, for several years now on this committee, agree that that's a good thing and gives Minnesota a competitive advantage, and it's something we want to continue to protect in Minnesota because it helps our economy and our businesses. And so, you know, on the one hand, you know, we're looking at the energy price as a dilemma with SIP. On the other hand, we want to protect and keep our energy prices low. Mm-hmm. And we also provide for, so exempting new loads and the customer demographics, we do provide for, similar to the RES, kind of soft landings and off ramps and that sort of thing, and also to control for natural growth in the energy demands that's in the bill. Now, if we didn't quite get it right, we need to take another look at it. Let's take another run at it. But I don't want people to also leave laboring under the impression that we hadn't thought about that and made those provisions. in the 2007 statute.
Senator Stone?
I think one other thing that in visiting with a lot of people in the last several years, our energy costs, and I'm just talking personal, but everybody I've talked to have doubled. You know, so the actual cost per kilowatt hour has gone up, and it has been noticeable when you get your electric bill, and whether you're a retired person or whether you're a business or whether you're a family, everybody notices that the cost of your energizing your home or your business has gone up significantly. And, of course, you add the economy onto that, and you have a lot of unrest out there.
Well, Matt, energy has not gone up because of SIP. SIP is not a reason for energy going up. SIP is a reason for energy, both in terms of how much energy we're using and the cost of energy coming down.
Mm-hmm. I think this we're going to have to end this committee. I think everybody's got really great comments about this. Absolutely, the SIP program needs to be looked at, and perhaps if there's some adjustment, which I think it can be done to make it work for all the utilities, I think that's important. Those questions are obviously, are we going to adopt or adopt all those? I don't know, but I absolutely want to encourage anybody who would like to be a part of the stakeholders group to get a hold of Peter Mavis here, my CA, or Mr. Fuller, or myself, and we'll continue on. I was hoping if anybody wants to stay and we'll continue discussing it, that's wonderful, but it sounds like there's a lot of action going outside. So, with that, just briefly, Thursday we're going to go over the governor's budget. Now, we do have budget in this committee, unlike the previous years. And in the House, they have, of course, environment and natural resources and energy. But we have the budget portion in this. So we will be reviewing the governor's recs Thursday. Next Tuesday, we have our MISO tour. Senator Metzen, godfather of energy. And hopefully there's not a storm. Like there was last time. I heard there's another storm coming. So with that, and then I think at the end of next week, we're going to start working on the coal moratorium. So with that, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much. And for anybody that would like to come up and we'll start talking about the stakeholders group, I welcome you to the front here.